event.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Gaining Ground, a feature-length documentary film by Elaine Velasquez and Barbara Bernstein on Wednesday, September 30th, and Thursday, October 1st at Cinema 21 in Portland. Gaining Ground tells the stories of farmers making extraordinary changes in their farming practice so they can feed their local communities sustainably grown produce and grains. The documentary interweaves experiences of urban farmer activists, large farms in transition, and small family farmers. Again, that's Gaining Ground, Wednesday, September 30th, and Thursday, October 1st, at Cinema 21, 616 Northwest 21st Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Good morning and welcome to Between the Covers. I'm David Naiman, your host. It would be hard to overstate the accomplishments of today's guest, nor their influence upon and importance to the world of literature at large. Ursula K. Le Guin is the author of more than 60 books of fiction, fantasy, children's literature, poetry, drama, criticism, and translation. Her awards include a National Book Award, a Penn Malamud, 6 Nebulas, 5 Hugos, and 21 Locus Awards, from her 1973 Lathe of Heaven to her 2010 Cheek by Jowl, the most by any writer to date. In 2000, the Library of Congress named Le Guin a living legend for her significant contributions to America's cultural heritage. And in 2014, Le Guin was awarded the Medal for Distinguished Contribution to American Letters by the National Book Foundation, whose past winners include Toni Morrison, John Ashbery, and Joan Didion. Le Guin's books, their unique blend of sociology, psychology, and anthropology, have always been politically and morally engaged works, from the gender-fluid world of 1969's Left Hand of Darkness to a retelling of Virgil's Aeneid from the perspective of a nearly voiceless female character in her 2008 novel Lavinia. Le Guin is also active and figures prominently in the community of writers in the world. She's one of the founding members of Literary Arts here in Portland, along with Ken Kesey, William Stafford, and Brian Booth. And writers from Neil Gaiman, Zadie Smith, David Mitchell, and Salman Rushdie have cited Le Guin as a major influence on their work. Ursula K. Le Guin has also made the news quite a bit lately. In 2008, Occupy Oakland activists fashioned shields to appear like the cover of her anarchist utopian classic, The Dispossessed. In 2009, Le Guin publicly resigned from the Authors Guild to protest the settlement with Google, getting hundreds of authors to join her in petitioning a federal judge to exempt the U.S. from the settlement that would allow Google to digitize books with disregard to copyright. And most recently, in 2014, in what has been characterized as the most ferocious speech in National Book Foundation history, Ursula Le Guin used the acceptance speech as an opportunity to lambast the deepening corporatization and commodification of books and their authors by the likes of Amazon. Le Guin's thoughtful, principled, and progressive insights are also evident in her approach to teaching the craft of writing. And it is this topic she is here to talk about today. Her 1998 classic, Steering the Craft, has been revised and rewritten. And this new edition, Steering the Craft, a 21st Century Guide to Sailing the Sea of Story, out this month from Mariner Books, has been hailed as a book that deserves to have a place on every writer's shelf and was called by Library Journal in their starred review a must-read for intermediate and advanced writers of fiction and memoir. Welcome to Between the Covers, Ursula K. Le Guin.
Thank you, David.
So, Ursula, the original edition was a classic in the field of the craft of writing. But after 10 years of being out in the world, you realized that it needed to be revised, or you wanted to revise it, that enough had changed in the publishing world and in the world of writers that it needed a new life. Tell us about what had changed and what's different about the new edition of Steering the Craft.
Well, it's the same book, but every single sentence was rewritten. And part of it was just that I was 10, 12 years older, and looked back on some of the things I said and thought, that's not quite right. I can say that better. Also, I got feedback from people who used the book, like about the exercises and so on, and that was really good. So I could use, you know, reader feedback. And then there was this whole essentially sort of revolution that has overturned publishing as it existed, even in the late 90s when the book was written. And we're all sort of really out at sea now on that one, not knowing quite what's going to happen next. And so some of the old advice that one always gave to young writers is just no good anymore. It's kind of, you know, steering one's craft these days. Really, it's nobody quite knows where they're going, including the publishers.
Well, you say at the beginning of Steering the Craft, it's a handbook for storytellers. Mm-hmm. And yet it's not so much geared towards the beginning storyteller. It's for people who are already engaged in working on their craft with some dedication. What distinguishes it as a craft book for people who are maybe a little farther along in writing than someone who's just starting?
Well, for one thing, it simply doesn't do all the you can write sort of encouragement thing. It grew out of a workshop at Flight of the Mind. And the people in that workshop were all committed writers already. Many hadn't published. That's not the point. It's the commitment that counts. And so I just sort of assume that commitment in the book, and that you're really interested not so much in being a success as a writer or something, or just being a writer, as in writing well, telling your story the best you can. And it's lovely how people respond to that, and that is what they want.
One of the things that I think is really interesting about the book is you don't shy away from using imitation as a way to learn to write. And that's something very common in other fields. Painters, obviously, probably dancers and other art
musicians,
forms are always imitating in order to find their voice and to hone their craft. But it's something that writers traditionally have seemed a little shy or a little worried about.
Maybe not traditionally, but sort of 20th century. The thing is, with writing, it gets confused with plagiarism. Imitation in the arts has to be seen by the person doing it as a learning device. And particularly the internet has confused an awful lot of people, and competition in college for writing papers. Plagiarism is sort of blurred into imitation. And of course they're totally different things, so they have different purpose. You imitate only to learn, and you don't publish it. Or if you do, you say this is an imitation of Hemingway or something, you know. But it got all blurred, and so a lot of teachers began to really scold people for imitating in fiction or in writing. And that's you know, that's kind of foolish, because you have to learn by reading good stuff and trying to write that way. There, you know, a piano player who never heard any other piano players, how would he know what to do? We're not using imitation as it could be used, I think.
Yeah, that's a good point. You open the book with the importance of sound. The sound of language, you say, is where it all begins, and that language at its core is a physical thing. Can you talk a little bit about the importance of sound for you and in relationship to storytelling?
I hear what I write. I started writing poetry when I started writing real young, you know. When I learned to write, I started writing. And I've always heard it in my head. And I realized that a lot of people who write about writing really don't seem to hear it. They don't listen to it. And there's a kind of theoreticalness about what they talk about, the length of sentences and stuff. It's all more sort of intellectual. But if it's happening in your body, if you're hearing what you write, you're going to you're going to hear the right cadence of the sentence, which will help the sentence run clear. And what young writers always talk about, finding their voice. Well, you can't find your own voice unless you're listening for it. And the sound of your writing is maybe leading you into something that you did. I think most of our writing, our teaching of writing, kind of ignores it. Hmm. Except maybe when people read poetry and then they listen to the sound of it. But prose, they forget that, you know, there's prose that goes clunk, clunk, clunk. There's an awful lot of it.
You have this wonderful quote from your talk at Literary Arts and Lectures in 2000. I'm just going to read it back. Beneath memory and experience, beneath imagination and invention, beneath words, there are rhythms to which memory and imagination and words all move. The writer's job is to go down deep enough to feel that rhythm and let it move memory and imagination to find the words. And I think you were saying this in relationship to Virginia Woolf.
That is essentially something that I learned consciously from Virginia Woolf, who talks about it in similar terms, her phrase, the wave in the mind.
And you cite Virginia as a perhaps the best example of the use of rhythm, I believe, in Steering the Craft.
She's just an amazing example of the use of a long and subtle rhythm in prose. Hmm. But there are many, many others. I did an essay about essentially the rhythm of Tolkien's writing in The Lord of the Rings. There are short rhythms and long rhythms, and there's a cyclical repetition in his work, which I think is part of why it totally enchants so many of us. We're caught in the rhythm and we're happy there.
Another thing that I think makes Steering the Craft a standout book is both your emphasis of knowing grammar terminology, and also your interrogation of it at the same time. So you stress the importance of knowing grammar, terminology, and not dismissing punctuation, because these are the tools of our craft as writers. Yet many writers, I think, are shy away from these tools. Talk a little bit about yeah. punctuation and grammar.
My generation, and for a while after, I was born in 1929, we were taught in public school, we were taught grammar right from the start. And everybody kind of went, somebody prayed again, blah, 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 you know. But all the same, it was quietly drilled into us, and we knew the names of the parts of speech, and we had a kind of working acquaintance with English, which they don't get in school anymore, in most schools. There's so much less reading in schools, and there's very little teaching of grammar. And for a writer, this is kind of like being thrown into a carpenter's shop without ever having learned the names of the tools or handled them consciously. You know, what do you do with a Phillips screwdriver? What is a Phillips screwdriver? So we're not equipping people to write. We're sort of saying, you too can write. Anybody can write. You can write. Just sit down and do it, you know. But you got to have the toolbox.
You talk in the book about the usefulness of diagramming sentences, that in diagramming sentences, sometimes you discover that the sentences have skeletons.
Now, I was not taught that in school. That was the previous generation. My mother and my great aunt could diagram a sentence, and they showed me how. And having that kind of mind, I enjoyed it.
Yeah.
And it is, for anybody who has that kind of mind, it's illuminating just to see. It is kind of like drawing the skeleton of a horse. Oh, that's how they hang together, you know.
Well, it's also interesting to think of sentences having skeletons and thus, in a sense, being different animals, which would then go back to the idea of rhythm and sound, because they would all walk differently.
They each has a different gait. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Right. In case you just tuned in, we're talking today to Ursula K. Le Guin about her revised and rewritten craft book, Steering the Craft, A 21st Century Guide to Sailing the Sea of Story. Well, every so often in Steering the Craft, you have an opinion piece. And one of my favorites is about morality and grammar. and you talk about how morality and language are linked, but how morality and correctness are not the same thing, and we often confuse morality and correctness in the realm of grammar. Can you talk a little bit about that? Yeah.
Well, that's where what somebody else gave me this phrase for the grammar bullies. They tend to write in, you read them in places like the New York Times and so on, and they tell you what is correct and what, and you know, you must never use hopefully, like hopefully we'll be going there on Tuesday. That's incorrect and wrong, and you are basically a sort of an ignorant pig if you say it. Well, this is this judgmentalism. And what the game that's being played there is a game of social class. I'm sorry. It has nothing to do with the morality of writing and speaking and thinking clearly, which, well, Orwell, for instance, talked about so well. It's just affirming, I'm from a higher class than you are. And the trouble is that people who aren't taught grammar and such very well in school fall for these statements from these pundits delivered with vast authority from above, you know. And so I'm kind of fighting that. It's a very interesting case in point is using they for singular and how this is wrong, and offends the grammar bullies enormously. Well, it was a rule that was invented basically in the 18th century. It didn't exist in English before. Shakespeare used they instead of he or she. We all have always done it in speaking, in colloquial English. And it took the women's movement to sort of bring it back into written English. But it's important. See, there's a kind of crossroads between the correctness bullying and the moral use of language. If he includes she, but she doesn't include he, big statement's being made.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we got they. Why not use it?
Well, this difference between grammatical correctness and the way language engages moral questions is interesting. It reminds me of this quote that you've said, we can't restructure society without restructuring the English language. So essentially, the battle is at the sentence level as much as it is in the world.
Oh, yeah. And that, again, I read George Orwell's great essay. I can't remember what it's called, the one about writing English clearly being a political matter. I read that as a freshman in college, and it went real deep into me. So often I'm simply rephrasing Orwell.
Well, and it's reflected in your work as well. Like I think of The Dispossessed, which is the novel about an anarchist utopia, and there's no property, but there's also no possessive pronouns. So there's a way in which the world and the language of the world are reflecting back in a sort of unison.
In the novel, the founders of this anarchist society made up a new language because they realized that using the old one was you couldn't have this society and that language. So they obviously they based the new language on the old one, but they changed it enormously, which is simply a kind of an illustration of what Orwell was saying, I think.
So lots of these rules that are really rules of correctness, which sort of reflect back maybe some regressive tendencies in society, you call fake rules. And so on the one hand, Steering the Craft really talks about the importance of really engaging with our tools, like using punctuation, understanding its power and understanding grammar, but also not falling for these fake rules. And you mentioned one around the generic pronoun he for both men and women.
Yeah.
And the way that is an example of erasing women at the sentence level. And I also remember reading that you, if you could rewrite Left Hand of Darkness, your book that is way ahead of its time and about gender fluidity, you would make some different changes on the sentence level. Is that true? Would you make some changes around the use of pronouns? And
obviously, it's unsatisfactory to call these genderless people he all the way through the book, as I do, unless one of them goes into camera and has gender, and then it becomes genuinely he or she. You cannot use they that way. That would be totally confusing. And made up pronouns drive me mad. When the book, soon after the book was written, particularly in the 80s, there were several books written with made up pronouns. And I just can't do that to English. But what do you do? I've tried this and that. I rewrote a short story and a chapter of Left Hand of Darkness, simply making everybody she instead of he. And it's very interesting to read it after having read the he version, you know. But it's not right either, because they aren't she. They're they. You know, but we can't do it. So I just envy the Finnish, and I think that the Japanese, at least in some respects, can speak genderlessly. Mm-hmm. And so I'm just envious.
Yeah. Well, to look at this micro and macro issue, if we're looking at changing language and changing society, you've also raised concerns about the ways in which women writers get disappeared from the conversation, particularly when it comes to entering or not entering the canon. And I think in one conversation, someone asked you for examples, and you had mentioned Grace Paley, if I remember, as a possible person who may be sliding out of the conversation.
I fear for Grace's a reputation, because it is so, it happens so often that a writer who's very much admired, but never was not really, really a bestseller famous, you know, that however admired by many, many critics and all that, but she just slides out of sight so fast, and the place is filled by a man. Well, no man could possibly fill Grace Paley's place, because she wrote extraordinarily much as a woman. And that may be part of the problem. I don't know.
It was interesting. When I had Joe Walton on the show, we engaged this conversation. Mm-hmm. And she was saying, you know, it's difficult in any given moment to know whether, often it's difficult in any given moment to know when sexism's happening. But if you step back and look at the way the canon is formed, say, in science fiction and fantasy, she said, let's look at William Gibson when he wrote Neuromancer, won the Hugo and many other awards. And around the same time, C.J. Cherry also won the Hugo, I think the year before, seemed to be informing the conversation, won a Hugo again 6 or 7 years later, seemed just as successful. And now you look back and Gibson's in the canon, and a lot of people are, who is C.J. Cherry?
That's true. I hadn't really thought about it. Why has she been reprinted? Why isn't she talked about? There is something slightly mysterious about this. I mean, it's not always just simple sort of male prejudice. There is something else at work about how men work together without women. And I don't know. I can't take that any further.
Yeah. In case you just tuned in, we're talking today to Ursula K. Le Guin about her revised and rewritten craft book for writers, Steering the Craft, A 21st Century Guide to Sailing the Sea of Story. Well, you've been an outspoken critic, Ursula, of the continued commodification of books and the commodification of the authors of the books, and how sales departments are taking over from editorial. So a lot of the choices in how a book ends up being shaped and changed are less about art and more about commerce. In a way, I feel like Steering the Craft plays a subtle role that pushes back against that, in the sense that it really expands the way literature can be viewed, not just in terms of what's in vogue. So you're not against the choices that are in vogue necessarily, but you try to expand the conversation when there's a popular choice such as present tense or very short sentences. You both look at the limitations of those choices, but give plenty of examples of long histories of other choices. Would you say that's true?
Yeah, it's there are advantages and disadvantages to living a very long time, as I have. But one of them is you can't help getting a long view. You've just seen it. You've seen it come and seen it go. And you can recognize a sort of trendy thing that is being announced as the absolute way you must write. And, you know, it's fairly visibly, well, that's the way to write right now if you want to sell right now to a right now editor. But there is also the long run. And yeah. I guess my book kind of stands for the long run in writing rather than the short term instant salability.
Right. I really loved your discussion of the costs and benefits, the trade-off between past tense and present tense. And obviously a lot of people are writing more recently in the present tense. And the past tense has a much longer history. But you talk about the way the past allows for a referring back and forth in time and space that is more mimicking the way our minds and our memories work.
Yeah, and is particularly connected to telling a big story, a story with some real depth. That is one of the major issues that I really wanted to rewrite the first edition of Steering the Craft, was that point particularly, which I had sort of sounded off on and thought about a lot. I was a bit snarky about. And it's a very complicated issue. Obviously, present tense has certain uses that are just it's wonderful for. But it is kind of being adopted blindly as the only way to tell a story by young people who haven't read very much. And I'm just kind of saying, oh, you know, it's one way to tell a story, but it's not a very good way to tell certain stories. It can be extremely limiting. I call it flashlight focus.
Mm-hmm.
You know.
Well, for sure.
You see a spot ahead of you, and it's kind of dark all around it. And that's great for, like, high suspense, high drama, cut to the chase writing. That's terrific. But if you you want to tell a big, long story, well, I've been reading Elena Ferrante. I am reading Jane Smiley's book, which moves year by year from 1920 up into the 50s. Writing that in the present tense would be maddening to read. And yet, it's very present. Each scene, okay, you're in 1932. You're in 1932. It's the present time. It could be written in the present tense, but it wouldn't work because it would be this flashlight focus instead of this sense of including past time, future time, and even the scenery around. It took me a lot of thinking to arrive at what I said in this book. Hmm. And that, you know, it may not yet be final. I never think what I think is final because I'm always finding out something else.
You've been listening to Between the Covers, and we've been talking today with Ursula K. Le Guin, the author of Steering the Craft. If you're interested in hearing the entire conversation, an additional 30 minutes of interview, by early afternoon today, we will have the entire interview up on the KBOO website at kboo.fm/betweenthecovers. Thanks for tuning in.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to present Zakir Hussain, October 7th, 7:30 p.m. at the Arlene Schnitzer Concert Hall in Portland. Zakir Hussain is most well known as a tabla player, and he will be exploring the impact jazz has had on Western and Indian music with special guests, including Shankar Madhadevan and Dave Holland. Again, that's Zakir Hussain, Wednesday, October 7th, 7:30 p.m. at the Arlene Schnitzer Concert Hall, 1037 Southwest Broadway in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events. K
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of What Can I Do? Spaceship Earth at Mississippi Pizza on October 4th from 5 to 8 p.m. Spaceship Earth is a multimedia production by Laurie DeMaron about being more mindful of our actions. Also performing will be special guest Eva Riversong of Portland's local band Soul Nectar. Again, that's What Can I Do? Spaceship Earth, October 4th at 5 p.m. at Mississippi Pizza, 3552 North Mississippi Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is seeking an individual or group to contract with to help build our next 3-year strategic plan. KBOO embodies equitable social change, shares knowledge, and fosters creativity by delivering locally rooted and diverse music, culture, news, and opinions with a commitment to the voices of oppressed and underserved communities. We have been serving the Portland community since 1968 and are one of the oldest independent community radio stations in the country. The person or group who is selected will co-lead the development of a strategic plan with the KBOO Strategic Planning Support Work Group, made up of volunteers, board members, and staff. More details about the application process can be found at kboo.fm/planRFP2015.
Think of home. Of a place where there's love overflowing.